Hi, and welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Carrie Gillen.
And I'm Megan Figueroa. And 2023 is here.
2023 is here, and it is kicking my ass. And yes.
Yeah, it's a rude year so far.
It is a totally rude year. And I have to read you. I don't even believe in horoscopes, like, at all. Like,
yeah, I know you don't. I know. Listeners, she don't.
But I have to share the Lunar New Year. By the way, happy year of the cat or rabbit.
Yes, it is. I am a year of a rabbit baby.
Or cat.
Born or cat.
Depending. Okay, so this is supposedly the horoscope for my year, which I'm a dragon.
Of course you are.
Yes,
you're
I
such
know.
A dragon.
Of course. Okay, dragon is into a people conflict year. Your relationships may become volatile. However, your mind is clear. This should help you get out of trouble. So, yeah.
Oh, that is uncanny.
I know.
Oof.
Yep.
Oof.
So.
I am so glad your mind is clear.
Yeah, I mean, most of the time, I have my moments, but yes, it's definitely in a clearer place than it was last year.
Yeah.
All right, so, speaking of animals.
Yes, I'm so excited. You gave me a little hint at what this was, but I really just have no idea,
so
actually.
This isn't science. What does that moo mean? Humans can make some emotional sense of barnyard babble.
Oh my god. And barnyard babble. I love the alliteration.
I know.
Adorable.
Well done.
A plus.
Yes. So this article explains how we understand our pets, right? Like, especially dogs and cats.
Yeah.
Like, we can hear them when they're upset versus when they're not upset. And then what about other animals, they say? So, like, what if it's like a pig or some wild animal? And it turns out that it's, at least according to this one survey of about 1,000 people, from across the globe, it says. So that's interesting. Most can pick up on an animal's excitement, but they don't necessarily know if it's, like, good excitement or bad excitement.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Meaning, like, if they're in danger, or are these, like, more like cows? Like, domesticated, so you're not really in danger from them.
You know, that's a good question. It doesn't really explain, like, all the different types of animals. Like, there's horses and cows and pig. So maybe it's just barnyard animals rather than wild animals. But
I want to know more about pigs, because I feel like, so they basically grunt.
They squeal. So a high-pitched squeal of a frightened pig sounds different than a boisterous grunt of a happy hog, it says here. And that's true. I feel like I have a pretty good sense of a pig, like when it's happy excited versus sad excited or like upset excited.
Yeah.
But
a happy hog. These people.
I know.
A little alliteration. They love it. Okay.
Yeah. So, according to this, humans are experts at picking up on the arousal and valence of other humans, even if they come from a very different culture or speak another language, but we just don't know. I'm not really sure about with animals. So, okay. So, oh, here it is. Four domestic mammals, pigs, horses, goats, and cows, and two wild relatives, wild boars, and Przewalski's horses. I'm not sure how to say that. Sorry.
Hmm. So, horses without little things on their backs. What are they called?
Huh?
Would you ride a horse and you put the thing on them?
You mean a saddle?
Saddle. Saddleless horses.
Well, yes, they're saddleless, but they're wild horses. They're not, like, feral. Like, in Arizona, there's some feral horses running around, right?
Yeah.
No, these are just, like, wild horses. Anyway, so it's an endangered wild horse native to Mongolia. They made recordings of the animals experiencing positive and negative emotions. So a horse readying to eat would produce a high-pitched neigh when that's positive. Like, hey, I'm getting food. And then a hungry horse would produce a throaty whine.
Sounds like me. And my dogs, honestly. Okay.
There's also sound bites from human actors who were recording saying meaningless sounds in angry, fearful, or joyful tones.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. You'd want that comparison, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there were people from 48 different countries, and there were 8 different languages. So unfortunately, that's still not capturing mm-hmm. the entirety of the world. But it's better right. than many other things where it's like
yeah.
very, very European or North American or whatever. Everyone was basically able to tell when the animals were aroused, right? Like, so, like, excited or super unhappy.
Yeah.
Actually, it's more than half of the time, so it's not all the time, but, you know, more than half the time. But they just couldn't tell, like, positive, negative very well.
Huh.
Although they were better with goats, horses, pigs, and wild boars, and humans. But bad with cows and wild horses.
Well, you know what? I was going to say, I have no idea about cows. I don't think I would be able to the moos, I don't think I, because they always sound kind of, the moos sound deep to me no matter what. So maybe they just sound like grumpier than I think they are.
Oh, it's interesting. I mean, maybe it's also like, you probably haven't spent that much time around cows, I'm guessing.
Well, you would be super right, Carrie.
Not that I have either, but I have a feeling that I've spent a little bit more time around cows than you. Just a little.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there are not many cows in, like, central Phoenix where I grew up.
It's one of the 5 C's.
It's true. We do have a lot of cattle around, but not... not in the barrio, okay?
Yeah, let me just say that. You definitely had to drive out of the city. And
Yeah. But goats. This is interesting to me. Does it say how, I mean, wait, goats neigh. Nope. What do they do? Megan. Old MacDonald. Okay, they baw. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they sound kind of similar to sheep. Sheep and goats sound similar.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe they can get higher pitched. I wonder if it's a pitch thing. Like, if we look at a spectrogram, are these linguists doing it?
Oh, probably not.
Right. So if you look at a spectrogram of these things and the pitch, I'm wondering if pitch is...
Okay, maybe, but, like, remember that the... So remember that when a horse is happy, it's actually higher pitched than when it's unhappy.
That makes sense to me. How higher pitched can a cow go?
I don't actually know. I mean, I don't really... You're right, they're pretty low animals. I mean, they're so big and like...
Right.
But I think I have heard them squeal a little bit. And so to me, it would be like the opposite. Like if they're squealing, it would be bad.
Unhappy? Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so I don't think pitch is like a one-to-one thing.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm wrong.
No, but that throws out my hypothesis, because I was thinking that it would be across, like, humans would assume. Well, that's why maybe they're bad at cows, because they're assuming, right? That higher means better. I don't know.
Yeah, that's maybe true. It's interesting, because what do the wild cows, the cows and the wild horses have in common, that such that we can't tell them their emotions apart?
Right.
I don't know. Anyway, food for thought.
Yeah, animals are great. They make me happy.
They are great. Anyways.
We're talking about something serious today, but I would say that it is a very fun interview.
It really is. And
so fun.
I would like to say that I did not get a copy of his book, and that is why I did not know anything, because it comes up.
Yeah, I thought she had. I did. It is really, really good, and you're going to need to buy it.
Yeah, I mean, our conversation is amazing, so it's, like, definitely makes me want to own the book, for sure.
And it's so amazing that, what, Carrie? It was very special. First time ever, we have a 2-parter.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, it's very long, so I decided to just kind of, around the halfway point, just cut it, because I was just like,
nope,
it's too long. So, yeah, we're going to have a second part later.
Yeah, and believe me, it's a guest that you want to hear more from.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Dennis Barron is the best. Like, I love him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say go buy this book about someone who is a bad person.
Well, absolutely. But he's also very charming. You could be a good person and not charming. And,
That's true. Yeah. Ted Bundy, anyone?
Yeah. So I guess that's the opposite.
Yeah. So anyway, you'll really enjoy this. Yeah. Glad to be back.
Yes. Enjoy.
Okay, so Dennis Farron is Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's a frequent commentator on language issues in the national media and has written a number of popular books, including recently What's Your Pronoun? Beyond He and She, and even more recently, his latest book is You Can't Always Say What You Want, The Paradox of Free Speech, which puts today's attempts to limit free speech into a to an historical perspective. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And we wanted to have you on for a while, but a book coming out is a great reason to have people on. So this yeah. is perfect.
Yeah, and actually I interviewed you for a different podcast for the previous book, which was so fascinating. So I'm excited to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Why did you want to write this book and why now?
Why did I want to write? I got interested in language and law issues probably 30 years ago or more when I was looking at issues of official English, attempts to make English at the federal, state, and local level the official language. And my perspective is always historical, so I look at an issue that's current, but you know what brought us here. What how was this dealt with in the past? And so over you know two and a half centuries of struggles to decide what language should be the language of government, of education, of public communication in various ways. It's been an issue in the New World for long. It's an issue everywhere. All over the world, and it becomes comes into focus now with since the collapse of the Soviet Union, all kinds of linguistic rivalries in former Soviet states, where different groups are jockeying for political power, social power, whatever kind of clout, economic clout that they can get, and trying to navigate how to set up a government, how to organize things, and what role language should play in those issues. So you've got issues in the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic and a number of post-Soviet states about you know what should be the status of the Russian speakers who were formerly, you know, our political overlords, and do you boot them? Do you suppress them? Do you take out your vengeance against them? And what about your own minorities and your immigrant minorities? How do you treat their language? Do you give it any kind of status at all? Do you try to ignore it, suppress it? So that's what got me on that kick. Why now? Well, I started the book actually 5 years ago, before free speech was such a big public issue. It's been on the front pages for the last few months. I mean, I was just making a list of some of the stories that come up almost on a daily basis. A new governor.
Yes. Right? Yes.
One of her first official acts to sign an executive order banning the use of Latinx as a term. No one in the Arkansas government is now allowed to use it. Why single that out? You know, what's the significance of that?
And why does it feel like virtue signaling?
Right. Vice signaling.
You know, as I think one of you pointed out, you know, the term that seems to be succeeding more is Latine.
Yeah.
Just with the E vowel at the end rather than the X, because the X, as with a lot of gender coinages, the pronunciation isn't always clear to people, and they are reluctant to use it because they don't want to say it wrong, or they don't like it, or whatever. But you know, there's so many reasons for a new term not catching on that it's almost surprising when a term does have some success. Yeah. Yeah, the sign of success is attempts to suppress, right?
That's true, but is she also banning Latine, or is it just
Latinx? It's just Latinx.
I don't know. I didn't read the executive order. Usually I try to track down primary sources, but there are so many stories and so little time. Life is short.
Yeah.
You don't want to give too much ink to somebody like that. Anyway, you know, you've got worse stuff going on in Florida where basically the governor is saying the university instructional staff are state employees and that anything they say has to coincide with stated public policy and can't conflict with it. The employer controls your speech issue and how that plays out with public employees. So the Supreme Court basically in Garcetti said that a state employee can be censured for saying something against their employer's wishes. And so the issue is whether this applies to academic speech, and most courts say it doesn't. But there's never been a hard and fast decision on this notion of academic freedom. It's an idea that is supported rather than a legal doctrine that has been clearly established anywhere. So yeah, there's all that going on.
I don't know if you listen to the podcast 5 to 4, but they talk about, it's all about how the Supreme Court sucks. And like, that's their tagline. And I don't remember if they've done Garcetti, probably not, but they would probably predict that if it actually did go to especially this Supreme Court, that the employees would lose. And so then it would become the law of the land that, yeah, academics don't have any freedom, at least the ones at state schools. Yeah, so that's, anyway.
Yeah, well, and the ones in the private sector aren't doing so great if you look at what happened at Hemline.
Right, yes. Terrifying.
It's the whims of an administration rather than clearer adherence to some kind of due process.
Or any understanding of anything, like freedom of expression or speech or anything. So, speaking of... What is free speech and what is the paradox of free speech?
Right.
It feels so complicated and yet so simple, but it's not simple. And it's
both complicated and simple, because legal notions of free speech and the popular notions of free speech don't always coincide. So the legal notion, basically based on First Amendment doctrine, Congress shall make no law abridging a whole number of things, but one of them is freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people to assemble, peacefully assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances. But let's just boil that down to free speech. What that basically says is the government shall make no law preventing you from talking or writing or signing or however, you know, whatever counts as speech. Voting counts as speech, spending money on political campaigns, the Supreme Court tells us, and Citizens United counts as speech. Money talks, nobody walks. it's that simple. So I don't deal with the religion aspect of the First Amendment because,
yeah, that's a whole other can of worms.
That's a whole other thing. I have no expertise in that matter. I stay away from it, except when that gets intertwined with speech and something like the wedding cake baker or now the website designer who don't want to deal with same-sex clients, basically. So that where it impinges on public accommodation law and on anti-discrimination law. That's a tricky issue, and you know where the Supreme Court is going to land on that.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's
depressing.
That's for somebody else to comment on.
And I'll cry about it later.
Yeah. Anyway, so the legal aspect of free speech just has to do with whether or not the government can establish limits on speech or whether it can't. I mean, the First Amendment says it can't. Shall make no law. No means no, except that the rights in the Bill of Rights are not absolute. None of them are ever treated as absolute. The right to speech is not absolute. The right to bear arms is not absolute. The right to the guarantee against self-incrimination is not absolute. There is the public emergency exception to that, which they dealt with the Boston Marathon bombing,
right,
by interviewing Tchernaev, who had not been read his rights because there was fear of imminent threat to the public if they delayed and gave him the opportunity to consult an attorney and things like that. He was read his rights later on. In case of imminent danger to the public, like is there another bomb? Are there more terrorists involved? Those sorts of things need to know trumps the individual right to silence and to counsel. And it's seen as a temporary or expedient measure rather than something that can be applied loosely. So.
I noticed you mentioned, and this is hits close to home because I'm in Tucson, that Jared Lee Loeffner, who who bore arms and caused a lot of damage, he said that the government was trying to to control our grammar.
Yeah,
that was one of his things.
He was a little bit of a nutcase, obviously, but that's a technical term. it's in the DSM-5. Anyway, he did say that, and people think pretty crazy things about what the government is doing, but basically it sums up the kind of anti-government idea that, you know, they're putting chemicals in the vaccines to control us.
Turning the frogs gay.
You know, and it's all a conspiracy with Jeff Bezos and you know, the international Jewish conspiracy and Soros and the bankers and Hollywood and, you know, all the traditional enemies are brought up. But okay, so what is free speech? There's the legal aspect, which is basically that the government is not supposed to make laws, but in fact, there are whole swaths of our communications which the government can ban, and the speech that is not, the courts have ruled, is not covered by the First Amendment include things like obscene speech, threats, incitement to violence, criminal conspiracies, getting together and plotting to commit a crime or convincing somebody else to commit a crime, lying under oath, false advertising, defamation. There are states that still have no swearing laws on the books, and they are occasionally enforced. People can get arrested in this country and in England for swearing in public.
Okay, wait, what? Which states?
I mean, I cite an example in the book from a woman in Georgia, I think it was, who was arrested for swearing. She was in her house yelling at her son, her teenage son, who had done something, you know, that she felt merited yelling at, using, you know, colorful language. But he was on his phone, and a friend overheard the mother swearing. And so they used that, the police used that as, even though, you know, that meant she was in public because her voice went out over the phone line, even though it was overheard rather than anything else. So she was arrested and fined for swearing in public. some woman was arrested for yelling at her husband because she used the F word because he put something heavy on top of a loaf of bread in the shopping cart in the supermarket. And she said, "You dumb fuck," or something like that. And somebody overheard and they arrested her. You know, I don't think you do jail time, but you know, you can be fined. Put some money in the county swear jar. And so anyway, there are things that, even though it says Congress shall make no law, it actually means Congress may make some laws that abridge your speech. So there's that. Then there's the whole issue of free speech in the private sector. That's not covered by the First Amendment. Okay. You know, when Elon Musk buys Twitter and positions himself as a free speech advocate, absolutist, although he probably has no idea what any of this means.
He doesn't. He clearly doesn't.
He doesn't know what he's doing. But, you know, rich boy playing with a new toy and trying to get attention and has no actual plan, but...
Yeah, as we all saw play out.
the disruptor, you know, could have been one of those 1950s TV cowboy movies, but cowboy shows.
Yeah.
So the private sector can do whatever it wants. Private sector sets its own rules. Now, there are some limitations, I believe, in terms of private control of speech, in terms of employer-employee relations. I think California has some special employee protections, but many states don't. And in those situations, your employer can basically dictate what you can and cannot say, particularly when it is company-related stuff. So you get stories also about how people post something critical of the boss or something that the company finds embarrassing. Even if it has nothing to do with the company, and they fire the offender, and they're typically within their rights to do so, because if you have an employment contract that says you can't say anything disparaging about the employer, can't share you know, business secrets with the competition, those sorts of non-disclosure requirements. And so on. There's broad control of employee speech rights. They can listen in on your phone calls. They can monitor your keyboard use on your computer. All sorts of things that the government can't do that the private sector can. So there's that. And people often confuse. You say, oh well, Twitter's limiting my right to free speech. This is a constitutional offense. It's got nothing to do with the Constitution. The social media platforms can make their own terms of service. They don't necessarily enforce them. As you know, they are not designed to be read by the user. They're designed to discourage you from reading them so that you'll just click OK and get on with whatever it is you need to be doing. They're written by the legal department to protect the owner from any kind of legal damage. So I did at one point read through the 27 pages of the AT&T terms of service, and they have things like if you are killed or injured in any way while using or trying to use, but being unable to use the service, we are not liable.
Wow.
It's a disclaimer. We're not liable if you get killed while you're using Twitter. Okay.
Yeah.
And then there's everybody else, right? We all have free speech. We can all say whatever we feel like, whatever pops into our head. None of us, either legally or socially, is immune from the consequences of our speech. So you can say whatever you want, but you might do better to think before you speak. Because
yes, people might not want to be your friend anymore.
It's exactly right. People can and are free to criticize your speech, object to your speech, challenge your right to speak, accept what you say, like what you say, and worst of all, for any writer, ignore what you say.
Yes.
That's the worst thing, right? It's one thing to get people mad. At least they're paying attention. But if they just completely ignore you,
it's worse.
That's the hardest thing for writers and stand-up comics.
Yes.
To deal with, right?
And I think this is why like so many people complain about being shadow banned, because they're like, I'm being ignored. Why isn't anyone listening to my amazing social media speech?
Exactly. You don't get those likes.
Right. Those sweet, sweet likes, baby. Yeah.
It's youngest child syndrome. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
I was talking, you know. So even if the government must permit you to speak, it doesn't mean people have to like what you say. They can object to it. They can make lots of noise so you can't be heard. Right? Mm-hmm. They can heckle.
That's their free speech.
They can heckle. And in fact, the Supreme Court has said on a number of occasions that what is called the heckler's veto, that's when a speaker is prevented by a government agency university, police, whatever, from speaking because they fear that there could be a violent reaction to that speech. That's called the heckler's veto.
Oh.
And the courts have said that is not a valid excuse for interfering with someone's speech. It's tricky because that was the argument that forced the federal court to allow the demonstration in Charlottesville.
Right.
That led to the riot. The idea was, and the ACLU defended the right to demonstrate of the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists on the grounds that they had signed a promise not to be violent. They gave us their word. And, you know, this is the ACLU argument, and they argued the same thing with the American Nazi rally in the 1930s at Madison Square Garden in New York City, that you can't use the heckler's veto to ban the Nazis from speaking or to ban the Nazis from marching in Skokie in the 1970s or the so-called free speech rally in Charlottesville in 2017, I think it was, on the grounds that you're afraid that violence could erupt because the police will be there to prevent that from happening. And of course, in Charlottesville, they did not prevent it from happening. In Skokie, they did. At Madison Square Garden, they didn't. The Nazis spoke, and then protesters were kept outside. And after the rally, everybody in the audience went outside and started beating up the protesters. And the police just stood there, you know, because that's what they do.
Some of those that were forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces draw the same that burn crosses.
And crowd control wasn't as refined as it is now. In terms of keeping the two sides separate, which is the ideal way to go about it. When the Charlottesville people declared a second march on Boston Common a couple of weeks after that, and I think it was 50 demonstrators, 50 neo-Nazis show up and 20,000 people show up to protest the neo-Nazis, there was no violence. Okay, because the Boston police handled it. Yeah, and in Charlottesville, Virginia is an open carry state. Massachusetts is not. And
That's huge.
The neo-Nazis brought their guns to town, and that did not help things either.
So that's a big way that the First and Second Amendments are interacting.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Second Amendment is winning when you allow guns at political rallies over controversial issues. The Constitution is not supposed to be a suicide pact.
Right.
Right. It was not intended to support yet another revolution. The Constitution is a document that is meant to make sense of the previous revolution and to prevent undermining the new government. And what people are doing with the Second Amendment is basically perverting it to say that we need it to defend ourselves against a tyrannical government. And all these people are running for Congress or political office on a platform that is anti-government. And then, you know, how does that make any sense?
I mean, it doesn't to me, but
doesn't.
This is when you go and build your cabin in Idaho and live, you know, with a wood stove and power tools.
And start mailing bombs everywhere.
Yeah, don't be Zelensky.
Definitely get off the internet because, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, you can't build your bombs now without the internet to show you how. So
that's true. So that actually reminds me, like, one of the questions I wanted to ask was, how has, like, new technology changed our ideas about free speech?
Okay, so in complicated and probably very predictable ways, because what has happened, since the 1990s, as more and more people, certainly in the West, have adopted the computer as their main means or online devices, tablets and mobile phones, as well as their main devices of communication, of learning, of finding out about things, of reading the news, of social interaction. Basically, everyone's become a writer. Mm. Right? We're all keyboarding all this stuff. Writing more and more, more than ever. The average person is probably, I don't know what kinds of quantifying studies there have been, but is obviously spending more time at keyboards, generating prose of various kinds than ever before in history. The community of writers is not just the community of readers, the community of writers has expanded drastically. Everyone's a writer. Now, there's always a backlash when something like this happens. Look at what happened when the printing press started impacting who gets to read, who gets to write. Look what happened when writing itself was invented. This goes back to my Better Pencil book, which is basically about what happens when technology of communication takes hold. More and more people adopt the technology, and that leads to pushback where authoritative types like government, religious bodies, parents, educators push back and say, well, you know, too much of this is going on. Too much screen time, too many people at the keyboard. They're writing stuff that is of no value, and we need some way to sift through all the garbage to get at the kernels, all the important stuff. And so there's a general sense that we need to impose some kind of censorship, some kind of rules of who gets to write, who gets to read it, some kind of quality control, some kind of editorial process. and so on. So what the computer does is skips the traditional publication editorial process of review, acceptance, rejection, editing, rewriting, fact-checking, all those things that developed over a couple of centuries with conventional publishing. The internet allows us to short circuit anyone with a keyboard and access to the internet and put anything they think or want or want to say or photograph, because we're all now photographers as well, online. And it's almost like you're guaranteed an audience. There's somebody out there who's going to read it, you know, whether it's picture of your cat or, you know, instructions on how to make a bomb or anything in between. Order hits on people, order, you know, banned substances, whatever it is. You can do it online, and it's a constant battle between trying to catch people who are doing bad things online and learning to evade the authorities. So keep spiraling, whether it's hackers or criminals or whatever. So, you know, we've got all these semi-science fiction studies of, you know, somebody sitting at the keyboard and all over some alien force has taken over your keyboard and your hard drive is suddenly fried and stuff like that. So more and more people creating language and putting it out there leads to attempts to censor that language. Some of them are not particularly justified, right? Some of them are things like Ron DeSantis saying, don't say gay. You know, you're not allowed to say anything about gender, but, you know, what if you're talking about conventional gender? As the laws are overbroad.
Yeah,
the way they're framed, they cannot survive a challenge because nobody knows what they mean.
So Governor Huckabee Sanders in Arkansas, that wouldn't win in the courts, would it, to ban Latinx, because it's not obscene language. It's, she actually called it pejorative language. But
isn't,
like,
it, like,
that's
it's
not true.
Policy within the government. I think they're allowed to do that, right?
Right.
Oh.
Yeah, that would be the defense, is that she's telling government employees in the course of their employment what they can and cannot say. And that has traditionally been okay with the courts. That's Garcetti. That's basically Garcetti.
And also relevant to you is happening in Arizona right now, probably elsewhere. The banning of singular they pronouns in Arizona.
No pronouns.
Yeah.
Now, if you can't use pronouns in the classroom, where teachers have been talking about pronouns since the days of Aristotle, right?
Yeah.
You're just going to have to use names only for everybody all the time. And like,
I know.
But yeah, it's overbroad because they say pronouns as if pronouns only means
singular they or the neo
gender
pronouns.
Inclusive or
yeah.
NB pronouns,
right.
or neo pronouns or, you know, coined pronouns.
It's almost as if they don't know what pronouns are.
They don't know what pronouns are.
Right. Or they don't care.
Yeah.
But it was it. No pronouns in the Bible. No pronouns
it's
in
my
the
favorite.
Constitution.
It's my favorite.
Yeah, no
pronouns. We the people.
We the people.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, whatever.
You mentioned incitement, and that's not allowed. Mm. And we all know that recently we had a thing.
Yes,
in the U.S.
We had a thing on January 6th. Is it incitement? Is it incitement?
Are you talking about Trump in particular, Megan?
Trump and what he said.
Trump in particular, absolutely. I would say that that's textbook incitement. If he uses the word fight something like 22 times in his speech to the crowd who then went and fought. Oh, you have testimony from people who were arrested saying they thought they were doing what he told them to do.
Yeah, they're right.
The defense is that, you know, he didn't mean it literally. And look, the argument there is when you know, Henry II supposedly said, will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest? And then they go out and kill
the bishop or whatever, whoever it was.
Yeah, the archbishop in murder in the cathedral. He did not issue a direct order, but he opined. And it's an apocryphal story. So we don't know if Henry actually said this about Becket, Thomas Becket, or whether the barons who committed the murder just got a sense that the boss wanted this guy out of the way, take care of it for me. You know, plausible deniability. So that would be Trump's argument, plausible deniability. And it's clearly a pretext.
Mm-hmm. And also, it's mob shit. The way he talks about things, like, everyone knows what he wants. It's mob shit.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, totally.
Well,
totally.
And he is the authority figure here, right?
He's the authority figure, and then he goes and watches this unfold on TV and does nothing to stop it. So that
for hours and hours, further,
yeah.
That this is how he wants it to go.
He really did. It's right. So clear.
Yeah, I think about how, like, because I think your whole thing, right? Since you're such a history buff, is like, what is it? Those who don't know our history are doomed to repeat it.
Mm-hmm. But even you know what? Knowing the history doesn't stop us from repeating it.
Nope.
Either.
So, it doesn't at all.
Yeah. Okay, the people whose rights that really, truly have been impinged upon when it comes to free speech, I think a lot about how we've tried to regulate the language that is spoken in the United States.
Oh, yes.
Because my dad, who was in elementary school in the 1950s, 4 miles from the Mexican border, but in Arizona, was not allowed to use Spanish.
Of course.
And if you use Spanish, corporal punishment.
Exactly.
And, yep.
This was common. This was common.
And it's still happening today. When I tell people that, they are shocked that something like this could be happening right now. And I'm like, I don't think you'd be shocked if you knew that our history with trying to regulate.
No,
which
what's shocking is the corporal punishment, because in most countries that's no longer allowed, right? Canada, it's
exactly.
Illegal. But in the United States, apparently it's still legal, which I didn't realize until very recently.
It's state by state.
Well, in certain states.
Well, state by state. It's state by state. But like, but as far as the federal government is concerned, as far as SCOTUS is concerned, it's legal. Because it's
right.
Never been litigated in the past however many years. But
right. And there's no federal law governing it. It's left to the states. I remember moving from New York, where corporal punishment in the schools is not legal, to Illinois, where when I moved here in the mid-1970s, it was legal. And I was shocked. Mm-hmm. They didn't use it.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, in the schools that our kids went to, but they could. And that bothered me. That they could.
Yeah.
No, it's grotesque.
It's used disproportionately against minority students, whether it's ethnic or a racial minority or a linguistic minority. The whole official language business, which I call in the book, the chapter on that is America's War on Language, which is really, I think, what it is an attempt to silence non-English speakers. And a long history of that, long history of it failing to silence them, that basically what silences non-English speakers is the social pressure of peers rather than school rules or municipal or state official language laws.
Yeah, so actually integration would actually serve their purposes better. It would get
exactly.
More people to only speak English, and yet they're still fighting it. And so it's an interesting...
Yes. Right. Keep them out of our schools, but make sure they speak English.
Right.
However we define they, we don't want
right.
Them here. It's very NIMBY.
Oh, God, NIMBY.
Yeah, NIMBY. Yeah.
This is, we have definitely had you for a long, long time. And thank you so, so much. Is there one last thing you would like to leave our listeners with respect to free speech or whatever you want to talk about?
Oh, yeah. My soundbite is scratch a free speech advocate, and you will find someone who wants to protect their own speech and suppress yours.
Oh, right. Exactly. That's exactly Dennis. It.
Yes. Thank you. This book is so good and so important, and you have all of this free advertisement happening because the world is falling apart.
I know, and you know, no one will be left alive to read it, but still,
probably some people will survive.
Future explorers from space will come upon a copy.
That's been banned from
the libraries in Florida, I'm sure.
Oh my god.
Well, certainly. Oh. Certainly.
Maybe even Arizona. Certainly not Arkansas.
Well, luckily we have a Democrat.
Yeah, not Arizona right now. It's a Democrat.
We're good.
Okay.
We're good for now.
For now.
We always leave our listeners with one final message. Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
Hey, we really appreciate you.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks, us. Great fun.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.